This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Inspired, How to Create Tech Products Customers Love, Second Edition. Written and performed by Marty Kagan.
Preface to the Second Edition. When I first considered publishing an update to the first edition of my book Inspired, I estimated that maybe I would modify something like 10 to 20% of the content. That's because there was very little of the first edition that I wished I could change. However, once I got started, I quickly realized that this second edition would require a complete rewrite. Not because I regretted what I had written, but because I believe I have much better ways of explaining these topics now. I had no idea that the first edition would be as successful as it has been. Thanks to the book, I've made friends all over the globe. The book has been translated into several languages, and despite being nearly 10 years old as of this writing, sales continue to grow, all by word of mouth and reviews. So if you've read the first edition, I thank you, and hope you enjoy the second edition even more. If you're new to Inspired, I'm hoping this new edition accomplishes its objective even better. When I wrote the first edition, it was before Agile was well established in product companies and before customer development and lean startup nomenclature became popularized. Today, most teams have been using these techniques for several years and are more interested in what's beyond lean and Agile, which is what I focus on here. I've kept the basic structure of the book intact, but the techniques I described have improved significantly over the past decade. Beyond changing how I explain the topics and updating the techniques, the other major change to the book is that I now go into detail on what I refer to here as product at scale. In the first edition, I focused more on startups.
In this edition, however, I wanted to expand the scope to look at the challenges of growth stage companies and how product can be done well at large enterprise companies.
There's no question that scale introduces serious challenges. And over the past decade, much of my time has been spent coaching companies through rapid growth. Sometimes we call that surviving success, if that gives you an indication of how hard it can be. I've received a lot of great feedback from readers of the first edition, and there are a couple of important things I've learned that I would like to address here. First, there really is a critical need to focus on the specific job of the product manager. In the first edition, I talked a lot about product management, but I tried to speak to product teams more broadly. Today, there are many excellent resources for product designers and engineers, but precious little available specifically for product managers who are responsible for technology-powered products. So in this edition, I decided to concentrate on the job of the technology product manager. If you're a product manager at a technology company, or if you aspire to be one, I am hoping this will become your go-to resource. Second, there are many people looking for a recipe for product success, a prescriptive guide or framework to how to create products customers love. While I understand the desire, and I know I'd likely sell many more copies if I position this book that way, the unfortunate truth is that's just not how great products are created. It is much more about creating the right product culture for success and understanding the array of product discovery and delivery techniques so that you can use the right tool for the specific issue you're facing. And yes, this means that the job of the product manager is not in any sense easy, and truth be told, not everyone is equipped to succeed in this job. All that said, the tech product management job is today one of the most desired jobs in our industry and is the leading source, the proving ground, of startup CEOs. So if you've got the desire and are willing to put in the effort, I'd like nothing better than to help you succeed. Part 1. Lessons from Top Tech Companies. In the mid-1980s, I was a young software engineer working for Hewlett-Packard on a high-profile product. It was a time, the first time, when artificial intelligence was all the rage, and I was fortunate enough to be working at what was then one of the industry's best technology companies as part of a very strong software engineering team. Several members of that team went on to substantial success in companies across the industry. Our assignment was a difficult one, to deliver AI-enabling technology on a low-cost general-purpose workstation that, until then, required a special-purpose hardware-software combination that cost more than $100,000 per user, a price few could afford. We worked long and hard for well over a year, sacrificing countless nights and weekends. Along the way, we added several patents to HP's portfolio. We developed the software to meet HP's exacting quality standards. We internationalized the product and localized it for several languages. We trained the sales force. We previewed our technology with the press and received excellent reviews.
We were ready. We released. We celebrated the release.
Just one problem. No one bought it. The product was a complete failure in the marketplace. Yes, it was technically impressive, and the reviewers loved it, but it wasn't something people wanted or needed. The team was, of course, extremely frustrated with this outcome. But soon we began to ask ourselves some very important questions. Who decides what products we should build? How do they decide? How do they know that what we build will be useful? Our young team learned something very profound, something many teams have discovered the hard way. It doesn't matter how good your engineering team is if they're not given something worthwhile to build. When trying to track down the root cause of our failure, I learned that the decisions about what to build came from a product manager, someone who generally resided in the marketing organization and who was responsible for defining the products we built. But I also learned that product management wasn't something HP was particularly good at. I later learned that most companies weren't good at this either, and, in fact, most still aren't. I promised myself that never again would I work so hard on a product unless I knew the product would be something that users and customers wanted.
Over the next 30 years, I've had the very good fortune to work on some of the most successful high-tech products of our time. First at HP during the rise of personal computers, then at Netscape Communications during the rise of the Internet,
where I worked as vice president of platform and tools, later at eBay during the rise of e-commerce and marketplaces, where I served as the senior vice president of product and design, and then as an advisor to startups working with many of what have become today's most successful technology product companies. Not every product effort has been as successful as others, but I am happy to say that none were failures, and several became loved and used by millions of people around the world. Soon after I left eBay, I started getting calls from product organizations wanting to improve how they produce products. As I began working with these companies, I discovered that there was a tremendous difference between how the best companies produce products and how most companies produce them. I realized that the state of the art was very different from the state of the practice. Most companies were still using old and inefficient ways to discover and deliver products. I also learned that there was precious little help available, either from academia, including the best business school programs, or from industry organizations, which seemed hopelessly stuck in the failed models of the past, just like the one I worked in at HP. I've had some great rides, and I'm especially thankful that I've had the chance to work for and with some of the best product minds in the industry. The best ideas in this book are from these people. You will find a list of many of them in the acknowledgments. I've learned from them all and am grateful to each one of them. I chose this career because I wanted to work on products that customers love, products that inspire and provide real value. I find that most product leaders also want to create inspiring and successful products, but most products are not inspiring, and life is too short for bad products. My hope in writing this book is that it will help share the best practices of the most successful product companies, and the result will be truly inspiring products, products that customers love. Chapter 1, Behind Every Great Product. It's my strong belief, and the central concept driving this book, that behind every great product there's someone, usually someone behind the scenes, working tirelessly, who led the product team to combine technology and design to solve real customer problems in a way that met the needs of the business. These people usually have the title product manager, but they might be a startup co-founder or CEO, or they might be someone in another role on the team who stepped up because they saw the need. Further, this product management role is very distinct from the design, engineering, marketing, or project manager roles. This book is intended for these people. Within modern technology product teams, the product manager has some very specific and very challenging responsibilities, It's a tremendously difficult job, and anyone who tries to tell you otherwise is not doing you any favors. The product manager role is usually very much a full-time assignment. I don't personally know many who are able to do what they need to do in less than 60 hours a week. It's great if you're a designer or an engineer who also wants to serve as a product manager. There are some real advantages to that. But you'll find out pretty quickly that you're taking on an immense amount of work. If you're up for that, however, the results can be impressive. A product team is comprised of at least a product manager and usually somewhere between 2 and 10 engineers. If you're creating a user-facing product, you would expect to have a product designer on your team as well. In this book, we explore the situation wherein you might have to use engineers or designers in a different location or from an agency or outsourcing firm. But regardless of how you assemble your team, this job and this book assumes you have a team assigned to work with you to design, to build, and to deliver a product. Chapter 2, Technology-Powered Products and Services. There are many kinds of products out there, but in this book, I concentrate exclusively on products that are powered by technology. Some of what we explore in this book may help you if you're building non-tech products, but there are no guarantees in that case. Frankly, there are already a wide variety of readily accessible resources for non-tech products, such as most consumer packaged goods, and for product managers of these non-tech products. My focus is on the unique issues and challenges associated with building technology-powered products, services, and experiences. Some good examples of the sweet spot that we explore are consumer service products, such as e-commerce sites or marketplaces, for example, Netflix, Airbnb, or Etsy, social media, for example, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter, business services, for example, Salesforce.com, Workday, or Workiva, consumer devices, for example, Apple, Sonos, or Tesla, and mobile applications, for example, Uber, Audible, or Instagram. Technology-powered products do not need to be purely digital. Many of the best examples today are blends of online and offline experiences, like finding a ride or a room for the night, getting a home loan, or sending an overnight package. It's my belief that most products today are transforming into technology-powered products, and the companies that don't realize this are rapidly being disrupted. But again, I'm only focused here on technology-powered products and those companies that believe they must embrace technology and consistently innovate on behalf of their customers. Chapter 3, Startups, Getting to Product Marketing Fit. In the technology world, we generally have three stages of companies: startups, growth stage, and enterprise companies. Let's briefly consider how we characterize each one of these stages and the challenges you are likely to face in each. I loosely define startup as a new product company that has yet to achieve product market fit. Product market fit is an extremely important concept that I'll define in the pages that follow, but for now, let's just say that the startup is still trying to come up with a product that can power a viable business. In a startup, the product manager role is usually covered by one of the co-founders. Typically, there are fewer than 25 engineers, covering a range of from one product team up to maybe 4 or 5. The reality of startup life is that you're in a race to achieve product market fit before you run out of money.
Nothing else much matters until you can come up with a strong product that meets the needs of an initial market, so most of the focus of the young company is necessarily on the product.
Startups usually have a limited amount of early funding intended to determine if the company can discover and deliver the necessary product. The closer you come to running out of money, the more frantic the pace and the more desperate the team and the leadership becomes. While money and time are typically tight, good startups are optimized to learn and move quickly, and there's normally very little bureaucracy to slow them down. Yet the very high failure rate of technology startups is no secret. The few that succeed are usually those that are really good at product discovery, which is a major topic of this book. Working at a startup, racing towards product market fit, is usually stressful, exhausting, and risky.
But it can also be an amazingly positive experience, and if things go well, a financially rewarding one too.
Chapter 4. Growth Stage Companies, Scaling to Success. Those startups skilled and fortunate enough, it usually takes both, to get to product market fit are ready to tackle another equally difficult challenge, how to effectively grow and scale. There are many very significant challenges involved in growing and scaling a startup into a large, successful business. While it's an extremely difficult challenge, it is, as we say, a good problem to have. In addition to hiring lots more people, we need to figure out how to replicate our earlier successes with new adjacent products and services. At the same time, we need to grow the core business as fast as possible. In growth stage, we typically have somewhere between about 25 and several hundred engineers. So there are many more people around to help, but the signs of organizational stress are everywhere. Product teams complain that they don't understand the big picture, they don't see how their work contributes to the larger goals, and they're struggling with what it means to be an empowered, autonomous team. Sales and marketing often complain that the go-to-market strategies that worked for the first product are not so appropriate for some of the new products in the portfolio. The technology infrastructure that was created to meet the needs of the initial product is often bursting at the seams, and you start to hear the term technical debt from every engineer you speak with. This stage is also tough on leaders because the leadership style and mechanisms that worked while the company was a young startup often fail to scale. Leaders are forced to change their roles and, in many cases, their behaviors. But the motivation to overcome these challenges is very strong. The company is often in pursuit of a public offering, or perhaps becoming a major business unit of an existing company, as well as the very real possibility of having a significant and positive impact on the world can be very motivating. Chapter 5. Enterprise Companies, Consistent Product Innovation. For those companies that succeed in scaling and that want to create a lasting business, some of the toughest challenges still lie ahead. Strong tech product companies know they need to ensure consistent product innovation. This means constantly creating new value for their customers and for their business. Not just tweaking and optimizing existing products, referred to as value capture, but rather developing each product to reach its full potential. Yet, many large enterprise companies have already embarked on a slow death spiral. They become all about leveraging the value in the brand that was created many years or even decades earlier. The death of an enterprise company rarely happens overnight, and a large company can stay afloat for many years. But make no mistake about it, the organization is sinking, and the end state is all but certain. It's not intentional, of course, but once companies reach this size, often becoming a publicly traded company, there are a tremendous number of stakeholders throughout the business working hard to protect what the company has created. Unfortunately, this often means shutting down new initiatives or ventures that could recreate the business, but potentially put the core business at risk, or putting up so many obstacles to new ideas that few people are willing or able to drive the company in a new direction. The symptoms of this are hard to miss, starting with diminished morale, the lack of innovation, and how much slower it is for new product work to get into the hands of customers. When the company was young, it likely had a clear and compelling vision. When it achieves enterprise stage, however, the company has largely achieved that original vision, and now people aren't sure what's next. Product teams complain about the lack of vision, lack of empowerment, the fact that it takes forever to get a decision made, and the product work is turning into design by committee. Leadership is likely frustrated, too, with the lack of innovation from the product teams. All too often, they resort to acquisitions or creating separate innovation centers to incubate new businesses in a protected environment. Yet this rarely results in the innovation they're so desperate for. And you'll also hear lots of talk about how it is that large enterprise companies such as Adobe, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Netflix have been able to avoid this fate. The organization's leadership team wonders why they can't do the same. The fact is they could do the same, but they'll need to make some pretty big changes, and that's what this book is about. Chapter 6, The Root Causes of Failed Product Efforts. Let's start by exploring the root causes of why so many product efforts fail. I see the same basic way of working at the vast majority of companies of every size in every corner of the globe, and I can't help but notice that this is not close to how the best companies actually work. Let me warn you that this discussion can be a little depressing, especially if it hits too close to home. So if that's the case, I'll ask you to hang in there with me. I'll try not to editorialize yet. Let me first just describe the process. Everything starts with ideas. In most companies, they're coming from inside, executives or key stakeholders or business owners, or outside, current or prospective customers. Wherever the ideas originate, there are always a whole bunch of things that different parts of the business need us to do. Now, most companies want to prioritize those ideas into a roadmap, and they do this for two main reasons. First, they want us to work on the most important things first, and second, they want to be able to predict when things will be ready. To accomplish this, there's usually some form of quarterly or annual planning session in which the leaders consider the ideas and negotiate a product roadmap. But in order to prioritize, they first need some form of a business case for each item. Some companies do formal business cases, and some are informal. But either way, it boils down to the need to know two things about each idea. One, how much money or value will it make? And two, how much money or time will it cost? This information is then used to come up with the roadmap, usually for the next quarter, but sometimes as much as a year out. At this point, the product and technology organization has its marching orders, and they typically work the items from the highest priority on down. Once an idea makes it to the top of the list, the first thing that's done is for a product manager to talk to the stakeholders to flesh out the idea and come up with a set of requirements. These requirements might be user stories, or they might be more like some form of a functional specification. Their purpose is to communicate with the designers and engineers what needs to be built. Once the requirements are gathered up, the user experience design team, assuming the company has such a team, is asked to provide the interaction design, the visual design, and, in cases of physical devices, the industrial design. Finally, the requirements of design specs make it to engineers. This is usually where Agile finally enters the picture. Anyway, the engineers will typically break up the work into a set of iterations called sprints in the Scrum process. So maybe it takes 1 to 3 sprints to build out the idea.
Hopefully the QA testing is part of those sprints, but if not, the QA team will follow this up with some testing to make sure the new idea works as advertised and doesn't introduce other problems, known as regressions.
Once we get the green light from QA, the new idea is finally deployed to actual customers. In the majority of companies that I first meet, large and small, this is essentially how they work and have worked for many years. Yet these same companies consistently complain about the lack of innovation and the very long time it takes to make it from idea to customers' hands. You might recognize that while I mentioned Agile, and while almost everyone today claims to be Agile, what I've just described is very much a waterfall process. In fairness to the engineers, they're typically doing about as much Agile as they can, given the broader waterfall context. Okay. So that may be what most teams do, but why is that necessarily the reason for so many problems? Let's connect the dots now, so we can clearly see why this very common way of working is responsible for most failed product efforts. In the list that follows, I'm going to share what I consider to be the top 10 biggest problems with this way of working. Keep in mind that all 10 of these problems are very serious issues, any one of which could derail a team. But many companies have more than one or even all of these problems. 1. Let's start at the top, the source of ideas. This model leads to sales-driven specials and stakeholder-driven products. Lots more to come on this key topic, but for now, let me just say that this is not the source of our best product ideas. Another consequence of this approach is the lack of team empowerment. In this model, they're just there to implement. They're mercenaries. 2.
Next, let's talk about the fatal flaw in these business cases.
To be clear, I'm personally in favor of doing business cases, at least for ideas that need a larger investment. But the way most companies do them at this stage to come up with a prioritized roadmap is truly ridiculous, and here's why. Remember those two key inputs to every business case? How much money you'll make, and how much will it cost? Well, the cold, hard truth is that at this stage, we have no clue about either of these. In fact, we can't know. We can't know how much money we'll make because that depends entirely on how good the solution turns out to be. If the team does an excellent job, this could be wildly successful and literally change the course of the company. The truth, however, is that many product ideas end up making absolutely nothing. And that's not an exaggeration for effect. Literally nothing. We know this from A/B testing. In any case, one of the most critical lessons in product is knowing what we can't know. And we just can't know at this stage how much money we'll make. Likewise, we have no idea what it will cost to build. Without knowing the actual solution, this is extremely hard for engineers to predict. Most experienced engineers will refuse to even give an estimate at this stage, but some are pressured into the old t-shirt sizing compromise. Just let us know if this is small, medium, large, or extra large. But companies really want those prioritized roadmaps, and to get one, they need some kind of system to rate the ideas. So people play the business case game. 3. An even bigger issue is what comes next, which is when companies get really excited about their product roadmaps. I've seen countless roadmaps over the years, and the vast majority of them are essentially prioritized lists of features and projects. Marketing needs this feature for a campaign. Sales needs this feature for a new customer. Someone wants a PayPal integration. You get the idea. But here's the problem, maybe the biggest problem of all. It's what I call the two inconvenient truths about product. The first truth is at least half of our ideas are just not going to work. There are many reasons for an idea to not work out. The most common is that customers just aren't as excited about this idea as we are. So they choose not to use it. Sometimes they want to use it and they try it out, but the product is so complicated that it's simply more trouble than it's worth. So users again choose not to use it. Sometimes the issue is that customers would love it, but it turns out to be much more involved to build than we thought, and we decide we simply can't afford the time and money required to deliver it. So I promise you that at least half the ideas on your roadmap are not going to deliver what you hope. By the way, the really good teams assume that at least 3/4 of the ideas won't perform like they hope. If that's not bad enough, the second inconvenient truth is that even with the ideas that do prove to have potential, it typically takes several iterations to get the implementation of this idea to the point where it delivers the necessary business value. We call that time to money. One of the most important things about product that I've learned is that there is simply no escaping these inconvenient truths, no matter how smart you might be. And I've had the good fortune to work with many truly exceptional product teams. The real difference is how you deal with these truths. 4. Next, let's consider the role of product management in this model. In fact, we wouldn't call this role product management. It's really a form of project management. In this model, it's more about gathering requirements and documenting them for engineers. At this point, let me just say that this is 180 degrees away from the reality of modern tech product management. 5. It's a similar story with the role of design. It's way too late in the game to get the real value of design, and mostly what's being done is what we call the lipstick on the pig model. The damage has already been done, and now we're just trying to put a coat of paint on the mess. The UX designers know this is not good, but they try to make it look as nice and consistent as they can. 6. Maybe the biggest missed opportunity in this model is the fact that engineering gets brought in way too late. We say if you're just using your engineers to code, you're only getting about half their value. The little secret in product is that engineers are typically the best single source of innovation. Yet, they are not even invited to the party in this process. 7. Not only is engineering brought in way too late, but the principles and key benefits of Agile enter the picture far too late. Teams using Agile in this way are getting maybe 20% of the actual value and potential of Agile methods. What you're really seeing is Agile for delivery, but the rest of the organization and context is anything but Agile. 8. This entire process is very project-centric. The company usually funds projects, staffs projects, pushes projects through the organization, and finally launches projects. Unfortunately, projects are output, and product is all about outcome. This process predictably leads to orphaned projects. Yes, something was finally released, but it doesn't meet its objectives, so what really was the point? In any case, it's a serious problem and not close to how we need to build products. 9. The biggest flaw of the old waterfall process has always been and remains that all the risk is at the end, which means that customer validation happens way too late. The key principle in lean methods is to reduce waste, and one of the biggest forms of waste is to design, build, test, and deploy a feature or product only to find out that it was not what was needed. The irony is that many teams believe they're applying lean principles, yet they follow this basic process I've just described. And then I point out to them that they are trying out ideas in one of the most expensive, slowest ways we know. 10. Finally, while we're busy doing this process and wasting our time and money, the biggest loss of all usually turns out to be the opportunity cost of what the organization could have and should have been doing instead. We can't get that time or money back. It's no surprise that so many companies spend so much time and money and get so little in return. I warned you this could be depressing, but it's critical that you have a deep understanding of exactly why your company needs to change how it works, if indeed your company is working this way. The good news is I promise you that the best teams operate nothing like what I've just described. Chapter 7. Beyond Lean and Agile. People are always searching for a silver bullet to create products, and there is always a willing industry, ready and waiting to serve with books, coaching, training, and consulting. But there is no silver bullet, and inevitably people figure this out. That's when the backlash begins. As I write this, it's in vogue to criticize both Lean and Agile. I have no doubt that many people and teams are in some measure disappointed with the results from their adoption of both Lean and Agile, and I understand the reasons for this. That said, I am convinced that Lean and Agile values and principles are here to stay. Not so much the particular manifestations of these methods that many teams use today, but the core principles behind them. I would argue that they both represent meaningful progress, and I would never want to go backward on those two fronts. But as I said, they are not silver bullets either, and as with any tool, you have to be smart about how you use it. I meet countless teams that claim to be following lean principles, yet they work for months on what they call an MVP, and they really don't know what they have and whether it will sell until they've spent substantial time and money, hardly in the spirit of lean. Or they go way overboard and think they have to test and validate everything, so they go nowhere fast. And, as I just pointed out, the way Agile is practiced in most product companies is hardly Agile in any meaningful sense. The best product teams I know have already moved past how most teams practice these methods, leveraging the core principles of Lean and Agile, but raising the bar on what they're trying to achieve and how they work. When I see these teams, they may frame the issues a little differently, sometimes using different nomenclature, but at the heart, I see three overarching principles at work. 1. Risks are tackled up front rather than at the end. In modern teams, we tackle these risks prior to deciding to build anything. These risks include value risk, whether customers will buy it, usability risk, whether users can figure out how to use it. Feasibility risk, whether our engineers can build what we need with the time, skills, and technology we have. And business viability risk, whether this solution also works for the various aspects of our business, sales, marketing, finance, legal, etc. 2. Products are defined and designed collaboratively rather than sequentially. They have finally moved beyond the old model in which a product manager defines requirements, a designer designs a solution that delivers on those requirements, and then engineering implements those requirements, with each person living with the constraints and decisions of the ones that preceded. In strong teams, product, design, and engineering work side by side in a give-and-take way to come up with technology-powered solutions that our customers love and that work for our business. 3. Finally, it's all about solving problems, not implementing features. Conventional product roadmaps are all about output. Strong teams know it's not only about implementing a solution. They must ensure that solution solves the underlying problem. It's about business results. You will see that I keep these three overarching principles front and center throughout this book. Chapter 8, Key Concepts. In this book, I refer to a set of concepts that form the foundation of modern product work. I'd like to briefly explain them here. Holistic product. I've already been using the term product pretty loosely. I did say I'm only talking about technology-powered products. But more generally, when I refer to product, I mean a very holistic definition of product. This certainly includes the functionality, the features. But it also includes the technology that enables this functionality. It also includes the user experience design that presents this functionality. And it includes how we monetize this functionality. It includes how we attract and acquire users and customers. And it can also include offline experiences as well that are essential to delivering the product's value. If, for example, your product is an e-commerce site, then this would include the merchandise fulfillment experience and the merchandise return experience. In general, for e-commerce businesses, product includes everything except the actual merchandise being sold. Similarly, for a media company, we refer to the product as everything except the content. The point is to have a very inclusive and holistic definition of product. You are not just concerned with implementing features. Continuous discovery and delivery. I explained previously that most companies still have a process that is essentially waterfall at its core. And I told you that what we do in a modern team is very different. We'll be going more into the product development process later, but I do need to introduce a high-level concept about process at this point in our discussion. That is, there are two essential high-level activities in all product teams. We need to discover the product to be built, and we need to deliver that product to market. Discovery and delivery are our two main activities on a cross-functional product team, and they are both typically ongoing and in parallel. There are several ways to think about this and to visualize it, but the concept is fairly simple. We are always working in parallel to both discover the necessary product to be built, which is primarily what the product manager and designer work on every day, while the engineers work to deliver production quality product. Now, as you'll soon see, it's a little more involved than that. For example, the engineers are also helping daily on discovery, and many of the best innovations come from that participation, so this is not a minor point. And the product manager and designer are also helping daily on delivery, mainly to clarify intended behavior. But this is what's going on at a high level. Product discovery. Discovery is very much about the intense collaboration of product management, user experience design, and engineering. In discovery, we are tackling the various risks before we write even one line of production software. The purpose of product discovery is to quickly separate the good ideas from the bad. The output of product discovery is a validated product backlog. Specifically, this means getting answers to four critical questions. 1. Will the user buy this or choose to use it? 2. Can the user figure out how to use this? 3. Can our engineers build this? And 4. Can our stakeholders support this? Prototypes. Product discovery involves running a series of very quick experiments, and to do these experiments quickly and inexpensively, we use prototypes rather than products. At this point, let me just say that there are several types of prototypes, each for different risks and situations, but they all require at least an order of magnitude of less time and effort than building a product. To set your expectations, strong teams normally test many product ideas each week, on the order of 10 to 20 or more per week. I want to emphasize that these are experiments, typically run using prototypes. A prototype is not something that's ready for prime time and certainly not something your company would try to sell and stand behind. But they're immensely useful, as they're all about learning fast and cheap. Product delivery. The purpose of all these prototypes and experiments and discovery is to quickly come up with something that provides some evidence it is worth building and that we can then deliver to our customers.
This means the necessary scale, performance, reliability, fault tolerance, security, privacy, internationalization, and localization have been performed, and the product works as advertised.
The purpose of product delivery is to build and deliver these production quality technology products, something you can sell and run a business on. Products and product market fit.
Just because we've invested the time and effort to create a robust product does not mean anyone will want to buy it.
So in the product world, we strive to achieve product market fit. This is the smallest possible actual product that meets the needs of a specific market of customers. Marc Andreessen is credited with popularizing this all-important concept, and it is a major focus of this book. And just to be clear, since these are actual products, they are the results of delivery. The discovery activities help us determine the necessary product, but it is delivery that actually does the work necessary to build, test, and release the product. Product vision. The final critical concept is product vision. This refers to the longer-term objective of this product, normally 2 to 10 years out. It is how we as a product organization intend to deliver on the company's mission. So we use prototypes to conduct rapid experiments in product discovery, and then in delivery, we build and release products in hopes of achieving product market fit, which is a key step on the way to delivering on the company's product vision. Now, don't worry if you're hazy on any of these concepts. I know you likely have many questions, but they'll hopefully become clear as we dive deeper into each topic. It's also normal to be a little skeptical. How can I possibly run 15 of these experiments in a week? I warned you that strong product teams work nothing like most teams, and this should give you your first taste of how different things can be. Minimum viable product. The concept of minimum viable product, MVP, is one of the most important concepts in the product world. It has been around for many years. The term was first coined by Frank Robinson in 2001, and I wrote about the concept in the first edition of this book in 2008. It was popularized, however, in the book The Lean Startup by Eric Ries in 2011. Eric's book did a great deal to help product teams, and to me, it is a must-read book for all product people. But I think most people would likely admit that the concept of MVP has caused considerable confusion within product teams, and I spend a lot of my time helping teams get value out of this critical concept. The vast majority of times I meet a team that has been working hard to create an MVP, I am able to convince them that they could have achieved the same learning in a fraction of the time and effort. They have spent literally months building an MVP when they could have had the same learning in days or sometimes even in hours. The other unhappy consequence is that very often the rest of the company, especially key leadership in sales and marketing, is confused and embarrassed by what the product team is trying to get customers to buy and use. While this is partly a result of the way most people have learned this concept, I think the root of the issue is that while the P in MVP stands for product, an MVP should never be an actual product, where product is defined as something that your developers can release with confidence, that your customers can run their business on, and then you can sell and support. The MVP should be a prototype, not a product. Building an actual product quality deliverable to learn, even if that deliverable has minimal functionality, leads to substantial waste of time and money, which of course is the antithesis of lean. I find that using the more general term prototype makes this critical point clear to the product team, the company, and the prospective customers. So in this book, I talk about different types of prototypes being used in discovery and products being produced in delivery. Part 2, the right people. Every product begins with the people on the cross-functional product team. How you define the roles and the people you select to staff the team will very likely prove to be a determining factor in its success or failure. This is an area in which many companies fall short, stuck in old models of the past. For many organizations, the roles and responsibilities discussed here represent significant differences from what they're used to. In part two, I describe the key roles and responsibilities of modern, technology-powered product teams. Product teams. Overview. This is probably the most important concept in this entire book. It's all about the product team. You'll hear me say this many different ways throughout the chapters to follow, but so much of what we do in a strong product organization is to optimize for the effectiveness of product teams. Chapter 9, Principles of Strong Product Teams. In later chapters, I explore each of the key roles on a team, but in this chapter, I explain the principles of a strong product team. Product teams are sometimes referred to as a dedicated product team or as a durable product team to emphasize that these are not created just to work on a single project or feature, or sometimes as a squad derived from the military analogy and meant to emphasize that these are cross-functional teams. A product team is a group of people who bring together different specialized skills and responsibilities and feel real ownership for a product or at least a substantial piece of a larger product. There are many ways to set up product teams. We'll discuss these later in the section People at Scale.
But in good product companies, you'll find that, despite the differences due to their unique products and circumstances, there are several very important similarities.
Team of missionaries. There are many benefits of product teams, but a big goal is captured best by a quote from John Doerr, the famous Silicon Valley venture capitalist. We need teams of missionaries, not teams of mercenaries. Mercenaries build what they're told to build. Missionaries are true believers in the vision and are committed to solving problems for their customers. In a dedicated product team, the team acts and feels a lot like a startup within the larger company, and that's very much the intention. Team composition. A typical product team is comprised of a product manager, a product designer, and somewhere between 2 and about 10 to 12 engineers. Of course, if the product you're working on doesn't have a user-facing experience, such as for a set of programmatic APIs, you probably don't need the product designer, but many product teams do need this person on board, and throughout this book, I'll generally assume your team does too. Teams might also have a few other members, such as a product marketing manager, one or more test automation engineers, a user researcher, a data analyst, and in larger product organizations, a delivery manager. Don't worry if you don't yet know what some of these roles are, We'll soon explore each of them. Team empowerment and accountability. A big part of the concept of product teams is that they are there to solve hard problems for the business. They are given clear objectives, and they own delivering on those objectives. They are empowered to figure out the best way to meet those objectives, and they are accountable for the results. Team size. There's no rule that says all product teams in a company need to be the same size. It's true there is the notion of critical mass for a product team, usually one product manager, one designer, and two engineers. However, some teams might justify 5 engineers and 2 test automation engineers, others even more.
There is a practical upper bound on a team, which usually works out to be around 8 to 12 engineers.
You've probably heard about the 2-pizza rule, which is intended to help keep teams in this range. More important than the absolute size of the team is the balance of skills needed to ensure we build the right things and build those things right. Team reporting structure. Note that I haven't said anything yet about who works for whom. A product team is not about reporting relationships. It has an intentionally flat organizational structure. Usually, everyone on a product team is an individual contributor, and there are no people managers. The people on the team typically continue to report to their functional manager. For example, the engineers report to an engineering manager. Likewise, the designer usually reports to a head of design, and the product manager reports into a head of product. So, this is not about reporting relationships. To be absolutely clear, the product manager is not the boss of anyone on the product team. Team collaboration. A product team is a set of highly skilled people who come together for an extended period of time to solve hard business problems. The nature of the relationship is more about true collaboration. I don't mean collaboration as a buzzword either. I literally mean product, design, and engineering working out solutions together. Much more on that to come, but at this point, it's important for you to understand that this is not a hierarchy. Team location. I also haven't said anything yet about where the members of the team are physically located. While this isn't always possible, we try very hard to co-locate this team. Co-location means that team members literally sit right next to one another. That doesn't mean in the same building or even the same floor. It means close enough to easily see each other's computer screens. I know this sounds a bit old school, and the tools for remote collaboration are getting better all the time, but the best companies have learned the value of sitting together as a team. If you've ever been a member of a co-located product team, you likely already know what I mean. But as you'll see from how we do our work on a product team, there is a special dynamic that occurs when the team sits together, eats lunch together, and builds personal relationships with one another. I'm aware this can be a bit of an emotional topic. For personal reasons, quite a few people live somewhere other than where they work, and their livelihood depends on working effectively remotely. I don't want to paint this as too black or white, but I also don't want to mislead you. All other things being equal, a co-located team is going to substantially outperform a dispersed team. That's just the way it is. This is also one of the reasons why we greatly prefer members of a product team to be actual employees and not contractors or agencies. It's much easier to be co-located and to be a stable member of the team if the person is an employee. Note that there is nothing wrong with a company having multiple locations, so long as we try hard to have co-located teams in each location. We'll talk later about what we do when not all the members are able to sit together. Team scope. Once you've got the basics of a product team, the next big question is this: what is the scope or charter of each team? That is, what is each team responsible for? One dimension of this is the type of work to be done, and it's important that a product team has responsibility for all the work, all the projects, features, bug fixes, performance work, optimizations, and content changes, everything and anything for their product. The other dimension is the scope of work to be done. In some types of companies, the product team is responsible for a complete product. But it's more common today that the product is the full customer experience. Imagine a Facebook or a PayPal. And each team is responsible for some smaller but meaningful piece of that experience. For example, you might be working on a team at eBay that's responsible for technology to detect and prevent fraud or tools and services for high-volume sellers. Or, at Facebook, your team might be responsible for news feeds, an iOS-native mobile app, or the capabilities required for a specific vertical market. This is an easy topic for a small startup, as you typically just have one or a small number of teams, which makes it relatively easy to split things up. But as a company grows, the number of teams expands from a handful to 10, 20, 50, or more teams in larger product companies. The coordination gets harder. Much more on that when we get to the section on product at scale. But the concept is highly scalable and, in fact, is one of the keys to scalability. There are lots of useful ways to slice up the pie. Sometimes we have each team focus on a different type of user or customer. Sometimes each team is responsible for a different type of device. Sometimes we break things up by workflow or customer journey. Sometimes, actually very often, we are largely defining the teams based on the architecture. This is pretty common because the architecture drives the technology stack, which often requires different types of engineering expertise. In any case, what's critically important is alignment between product management and engineering. This is why the head of product and the head of engineering normally get together to define the size and scope of the teams. I will tell you that there's never a perfect way to carve up the pie. Realize that when you optimize for one thing, it comes at the expense of something else. So decide what's most important to you and go with that. Team duration. I've mentioned a few times already that these teams need to be durable, but I haven't said whether this means for a few months or several years. The bottom line is that we try hard to keep teams together and fairly stable. While things do come up, and people change jobs and teams, once the members of a team get to know one another and learn how to work well together, it's honestly a beautiful and powerful thing, and we try hard not to mess up that dynamic. Another reason that durability is important is that it can take some time to gain enough expertise in an area to innovate. If people are moving from team to team all the time, it's hard for them to get that expertise and to feel the necessary sense of ownership over their product and missionary-like passion. And to be clear, a product team is not something we create just to deliver a specific project. It's nearly impossible to have a team of missionaries when they're pulled together for a project that lasts only a few months and is then disbanded. Team autonomy. If we want teams to feel empowered and have missionary-like passion for solving customer problems, we need to give them a significant degree of autonomy. Obviously, this doesn't